You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside. Pull up a chair, relax, take a deep breath. We're your weekly respite from the rest of it all because, let's be serious, is there any better escapism than Midside Musings? And on that note, I just have to ask, will Canada be able to withstand the Burger King purchase of Tim Hortons? Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Stressed. I didn't. Fantasy football. Nonsense. Why do I let this get to me every year?
I don't know. I finally gave up on it. What are you stressing about?
Picking people for a team and how much they're worth in fake $200.
There is literally no way to make a right pick in that. You realize that, right?
Doesn't feel that way.
It's like shooting darts across the room blindfolded. You might get a bullseye, but then you're just getting lucky. Because so much happens in the season that any number of permutations could occur from your roster.
So spend all of my money on Adrian Peterson? That's what you're saying? Just dump it all on Adrian Peterson's head?
That's basically the best thing you can do, is then just try and scoop up all the major free agents that do well that nobody predicted every season.
Make it rain on Peyton Manning? Is that what you're saying?
That's Pac-Man Jones's job. He makes it rain in the strip club. But no, every year, every draft I've been in, people are always like, oh man, you have a really good team after my draft. And then what happens to me every year?
0-16.
Yeah, they all get injured and nothing happens. For instance, I am in one league. I'm in a dynasty league. And guess who I signed to this year? Wes Welker.
Whoops.
Yep. So we'll return to that later. Also not joining us, Elliot Rivera. He is currently at the House of Mouse scrubbing Dumbo's trunk.
I heard he was waxing Mickey's buttons.
Well, you do know what they say about those Disneyland employees. They're very gay. I mean, happy. They get around, right?
You mean gay?
Trying to be PC here.
Gay means happy.
All right. It's time to sober up, everyone. Drink some black coffee. Take a cold shower. Pour a bucket of ice water on your head. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
No, wait. Put down that bucket of water and take a deep breath. Step away from the water. At least if you're in California, because you folks are in a drought. That's right. Ice Bucket Challenge has now met its match, the California drought. According to some estimates, the Ice Bucket Challenge has used more than 6 million gallons of fresh water, and it's time to put an end to it. Jim Guilford, executive director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society, said, quote, fresh water is one of our nation's most precious resources. It is a resource that should never be undervalued or wasted. This becomes even more important when areas of our country are suffering from drought. So fuck you, ALS, ACLS, whatever suffers, disease people.
How long
Screw
until
you.
Hollywood makes a movie about all rich people who pour water to waste it because they feel guilty about it? You know, their typical have and have not movie they always make.
Yes, I'm waiting for the fresh water wasting movie. It's gone to meme form. This week, when we have the little African child meme, sure you've seen this one, the little African child staring suspiciously at this woman. He says, so, let me get this straight. You waste clean water as a challenge in order to avoid raising money for charity? He's got a cute little point, this child.
He does. It does show people's lack of context.
So, this story has so many layers, it might as well be an ogre. But
that was a good one. That was one of your best ones ever.
Thank
I
you.
Like that one.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I did tweet this week where I wanted to know. I said, but how does the ice bucket challenge end? And now I think we know. Global warming.
It all ends in global warming. This is a clusterfuck of liberal issues just colliding in one huge altruistic, orgiastic mess. Because on one hand, you have the, you need to either feel pain or give money to an organization by dumping a bucket of fresh ice water on your head.
And usually
and on the other
both,
hand,
by the way. They do usually do both.
Yes. And on the other hand, you have the other enviro whack job leftists screaming, but it's fresh water and we have no water. God damn it. There's fucking oceans desalinated. Yes, I said it again.
That's why I'm laughing. Because we're complaining there's no fresh water. In Africa, we're complaining people are dumping water over their head. It's literally the most abundant resource on the planet. Literally.
Started about desalination.
I can't even handle
I'll never
this right
stop.
Now.
I'll never stop if I start on desalination. Look, but the point here, I think, more than we're wasting fresh water, is we're wasting a lot of electricity posting video of ourselves wasting water.
What about all the data space we're wasting on our iPhones?
It's true. We must be using upwards of a million giga whatevers. To store these videos.
We're going
to
be beyond a terabyte at this point.
At least.
What about all the bandwidth we're wasting to watch these videos on YouTube?
There are children in Kansas still on dial-up. And we are wasting bandwidth with these videos of our wasting of fresh water while we waste electricity.
And the ice.
And the ice. Yeah, electricity to make the ice. Here's the thing. I've not yet been challenged to do the ice bucket challenge because I have no friends. But if I did have friends and if they did challenge me, I would have to tell them no.
What?
Thank you. I have no problem donating to charity. That's fine. It could even be morally awesome to do that. I have no problem with the marketing tactics of this particular thing. Here's what I have the problem with is being unconscientious about it. People are donating to this charity without knowing anything about it, what the disease is, how it affects people, maybe people in their family who've had it or have not, or whether their money could be better spent if they wanted to donate to charity, donating to another charity.
Wait, ALS people are dyslexic chat room users from AOL in the 90s, right? They're trying to say ASL.
Yes, age, location, sex. This is a terrible disease, Justin, and it's not to be taken lightly. Over 4,000 people suffer from this every year. Now, it is a terrible disease. But my point is, it is a disease that we should eradicate, 100%. I'm not pro-disease, have never been, can't accuse me of it.
That is a hardline stance, Daniel.
I know. But if we're going to take the Adam Carolla incredibly pragmatic approach about it, aren't there about 100 other diseases on this list that we need to eradicate first?
I don't know. How about AIDS and cancer?
I mean, cancer, just, you know, that's a biggie. AIDS, man, you know, whatever. But
what about hemorrhoids?
Eradicate hemorrhoids?
You gotta feel bad for people.
It's true. Bunions, those kind of things. No, my point is be conscientious about it. If you want to donate to charity,
each other with beanbag chairs for hemorrhoids.
I mean, there's been a lot of these sort of fake challenges that have come up, and I think that's one of my favorites. Hit each other with beanbag chairs for hemorrhoids. It also just rolls right off the tongue, much like a hemorrhoid.
Did you see Vin Diesel's?
Having to do with Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah, he did plant a tree for Groot, and people started doing it.
Of course they did. No, but people have been clever about it. There's, I think VH1 did the vanilla ice bucket challenge.
Oh, that's good.
I don't know what it was, but...
If I get challenged, I'm going to do the JML icy bucket challenge, where I'm going to pour icy over myself.
I see what you did there. In other stupid news, the FAA has decided that you, consumers, cannot plane share. Sorry. What is plane sharing, you ask? Look it up.
No, or use common sense. Make fun of all the audience.
Well, we do that on a weekly basis. Just kidding, we love you, Drew. Plane sharing is much like ride sharing, where you would, if you owned a plane, for instance, and you weren't using it all the time, other registered pilots could use the plane. Or if you were a pilot who was going to various places, you could pick up passengers and whatnot. Sort of like Uber or Lyft. But the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, has said no. There's a fact, it is illegal for private pilots to accept payment in ferrying passengers if the pilot is not a registered commercial pilot and the plane is a registered commercial plane, which is actually a fairly extensive process to do.
How is this not a law already?
No, that is a law. That's what I'm saying. And the FAA, so this company...
Wait, no, you're not saying they wrote this now to ban startups? That this law already exists?
This law already exists.
That's what I
thought. And what happened was that this company, Airpooler, which is a plane sharing company, wrote to the FAA, stupidly, and asked for a clarification on the law. And the FAA wrote a letter back that said, unequivocally, without any doubt, this is illegal. Don't do it. We'll kill you.
Except for the we'll kill you part, maybe.
No, that's in there. Hand to God. Hand to God, that's in there. Read it. Go read it right now. Don't do it. It's not in there. Point is, Uber didn't ask for permission when they went to do this.
Isn't this Uber... one of the stupid things kids say all the time? It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission?
Yeah. 100%. And Uber didn't ask for permission. They knew it was illegal going into cities and offering ride shares without a taxi license. And Uber said, fuck it, we're going to become so big and so important and so in demand that by the time they get around to trying to ban us, people are going to march in the streets over it.
Or not, because they have stupid Uber drivers.
Or that. Yeah, you just had a bad experience, right?
Yeah. I get in the Uber, right? And... you know, this is me after I ranted on Uber. I actually needed it. So proving that there is a valid market for this, right? Because I was like, I really don't want to take Uber. And I tried to do every way I could. But then I found a free Uber coupon. So I was like, okay, whatever. So the guy picks me up. And by the way, it was this big burly white guy with the Uber name Vito Bear. Ooh. So what do you think he was trying to do with Uber? And then we start driving.
Wax Dumbo's elephant trunk.
Yeah, exactly. He's looking to polish some buttons. So we're driving away from my apartment, and he says to me, so this could be your last ride ever.
And what? By the way, probably in the top 5 or 4 creepiest things your Uber driver can say to you.
Right, so I didn't say anything because I assumed he was being meta and he knew that.
You were preparing to tuck and roll?
No, I was just like, where's this going? I was like, he's either really going to kill me or he's going to follow up with a punchline. So I was waiting for the punchline because I assumed that I'm not worth killing because, you know, usually when serial killers target people, it's not the average height, average weight white guy.
I don't know. You do have a darn pretty mouth.
So I'm sitting there and I'm waiting. And then he goes, no, I'm serious. And I'm like, okay. And he follows up with, the Republicans are trying to ban it. Mind you, we're in California.
You mean you could have just said Jim. Jim, the Republican, is trying to ban it.
Or me, right? Because I voted Republican once in California.
God, don't say that out loud. They're listening.
So he says that to me, and I go, why would the Republicans do that? Like, I'm just saying, I'm incredulous because it just doesn't make any sense. And he's like, oh, well, they support the taxi companies and they support big business. And I was like, so they have their hands in the union? And he's like, yeah. And so I tell you,
it does not compute.
Right. The whole thing didn't compute. So I just gave him a platitude where I know the common ground I can have with him, where I said, well, that's, you know, I was like, not supporting small business isn't very supportive of business. Small businesses are business too, and that's stupid. So anytime he brought it up again, and he kept bringing it up, I just kept being like, yeah, that's stupid. That's not for freedom. That's not for supporting business, which, I mean, that's one of the major issues the Republican Party has, is they're not always pro-freedom and pro-business and pro, you know, the individual. So I wasn't saying anything I disagreed with, but, you know, I wasn't having a nuanced discussion with him because he was flat out lying, wasn't he, Daniel?
Well, yeah. When you told me that originally, I thought something is suspicious here, because in many cities, including Houston and D.C., and some other cities, it is the Democrats who are trying to stop Uber. One, because it's not as heavily regulated, and my God, if something is not regulated, it must be the devil. And two, because they are the ones who benefit from the taxi unions. And so I looked it up, and it is actually a Democratic representative from Concord in your fine state of California, who has written the bill.
Hey, this isn't my state. I have squatter's rights, okay?
Who has written the bill and is trying hard to basically, it's not to outlaw Uber outright, but it would basically make it impossible for them to operate, because it would put a weight limit on the amount of time it takes for them to get to you.
Well, if there's a weight limit, this guy definitely wouldn't be allowed to drive anymore.
Wordplay. And it would add a severe amount of regulations and a severe amount of safety regulations that taxis don't even have to abide by. So Uber's trying very hard to fight it, but it is definitely, shitty as they are, it's not the Republicans. Sorry.
Yeah,
it's not.
This guy isn't to be taken seriously. He had a bunch of blow pops in the back seat, and when...
Oh my God.
When I left, he asked me if I wanted one, and I was like, no, thank you. So this guy had a gimmick, and then
date rape blow pops.
This isn't even the worst part about this guy. Are you ready?
You'll end up blowing me later, pops.
I know that was like a clever euphemism in high school, right? You would buy the girls blow pops, right?
At
least
yeah,
that's what the guy
clever.
Did in my school. But
hand girls a pocket of screws. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
So, you know, this is the worst that, right? This is the cherry on top of this guy, right?
And, don't
as if
say
you
that.
Needed that image. So he somehow finagled the system so he could operate his Uber in both Orange County and Los Angeles. And he was telling me his stories about how he had to go to L.A. for a while because there wasn't enough business in Orange County, but now he's back in Orange County. You want to know why he came back to Orange County? Because he couldn't stand the commute to L.A. Now, I understand there's traffic for when you're working normal hours. But when you are Uber, you can commute to L.A. whenever you want. And it's a pretty easy drive from Orange County to L.A. in the middle of the night. Or also, 6 a.m.
Yeah, also he's in a fucking car. It goes really fast.
And he drove a Prius.
Oh, well. I couldn't stand the commute either, because I'd be the whole time going, get me out of this Prius.
It's funny because I've always hated Prius drivers on the road, and now I have my empirical anecdotal evidence.
It's funny, the sort of opposite of that, I won't get into a long story, but basically every cab I've been in since Uber became popular, I've gotten a lecture from the cab driver about how terrible Uber is, and every time I have to tell them to shut up.
So let's get
Speaking
back to
of,
the plane thing.
Oh, it's over. Who cares?
Well, I just
they banned plane sharing.
We're
not going
to
do anything
this.
About it.
I just want to make one point about it. Ready?
All right.
I think one of the greatest travesties about the lack of a free market in this country's history is that the government has always regulated air traffic control.
That's very true. Very true.
Travel is the word I was looking for.
Air traffic control. Travel. Traffic control.
Just want to say that.
That's true. The lack of innovation in that business is largely due to the fact that it's so ridiculously regulated. So, thanks, Uncle Sam. Have a blow pop. Speaking of things that blow, I don't know how to make a transition out of that. The NFL is asking musicians for a little bit of something-something on the side if they play the Super Bowl, if you know what I mean. And I mean money. The league wants people like Rihanna, Katy Perry, or Coldplay, who are their top choices to perform at this year's Super Bowl, to give them, you know, a little something on the side there, a little payback when it comes time for their Super Bowl tour, post-Super Bowl tour earnings. This has been reported by Rolling Stone as well as many other places. It's not meeting with much excitement, as you might expect, from these various artists. No official reports yet, but unofficial reports have Katy Perry going, go fuck yourself, and Rihanna telling them to words I can't repeat in pleasant company.
Well, then you can say it now.
Oh, go shove this dollar up your tight wad. I think that's a racial slur for Jew ass.
Isn't Katy Perry just mad because she's finally, it's finally been revealed how she has a career? She just pays everyone and pretends that people are actually paying to see her.
Yeah, where did she get that money though? Is she independently wealthy? Did she marry into money?
It's God money, because her parents are like preachers, aren't they?
It's God money. I can see Jesus turning over tables now. Her
Jesus
merch tables.
Does turn over tables every time he hears a Katy Perry song. Every time he hears it's the Eye of the Tiger, he just flips tables.
I think the most disappointing thing about this story was not that the NFL asked them to pay, but the NFL didn't ask Weird Al if he wanted to be included in this list.
He's the number one selling artist, or he was the number one selling artist in the world.
In the world. I think he really, and this goes back to, there was a petition going around for Weird Al to be the Super Bowl halftime show, and it got a gazillion signatures. It's probably approaching a million at this point, signatures, which is incredible.
Yeah, which is still a fraction of a fraction of the NFL's audience.
Well, I mean, it's less than 1% of halftime viewers. Last year.
Yeah, the 99% should not give in to the 1% of Weird Al fans.
Last year, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who played with Bruno Mars, drew about 115 million viewers, whereas only 112 million viewers actually watched the game. So of course the NFL wants a little piece of that, just a little. They just want to wet their beak just a little bit, you know.
But
and that's fine.
Didn't
I don't
less
care.
People
but...
watch the game. Didn't fewer people watch the game because of Peyton Manning? I mean, I don't think you can ignore that variable. I mean, he kind of laid a huge goose egg.
It's true. I think the 112 million tuned in for about 20 minutes, and then it was about 12 million diehard Denver fans.
No, it was about however many people live in Seattle.
Oh. They watched it too, although I think they were mostly drunk by that point.
And the New England fans were probably watching too out of enjoyment.
Yeah. Take that, forehead. Yeah. Speaking of people who want to get paid more, Elmo, Spider-Man, minion thing dressed up as Superman. Of course, these aren't the real people. They're just people who dress up like them in places like Times Square.
Did you just explain a meta costume?
Yes.
So it was a guy dressed as Minion, and the Minion dressed as Superman?
Yes, correct.
Have you actually seen that?
It's the actual picture that comes with this news article, yes.
Wow.
So in New York, all of these street performers have finally created basically a union-y type group called New York Artists United for a Smile. And
could they have picked a creepier name? Is Vito Bear in this?
New York Artists United for a Smile and a Fiver is really what it should say. That is hoping to create a culture of respect for street performers who are dressing up. Woody, the cowboy from Toy Story, held up a sign that said, "We have rights." I find this all immensely funny, but also deeply ironic in a way that literally no news story has mentioned. I have looked at this story on Republican websites, leftist websites, everywhere. Not a single website has brought up the fact that when they say we have rights, they're also forgetting the fact that they are violating copyright and trademark like you could not believe.
Yeah, it seems kind of obvious.
It's obvious. No one has brought it up. Everyone has talked about the nuances of, well, do they have the right to ask you for money, or can they perform but not ask you for money? And what if you take a picture with them and you don't give them money? They're doing this illegally. None of them have gotten the rights to perform as these characters. Do you think Disney or DreamWorks or whoever did the Minion thing wants a fat guy out there with half his stomach hanging out and a Superman S on the shirt, mixing and matching the multiple trademarks. That's not good for their brand.
Right, and they're always very poor versions of the costumes too. They're not like high quality versions because these people are lazy and they're just looking to make a quick buck off of somebody else's hard work.
Right. If anything, the police should be shutting them down, not giving them more rights to ask for money.
Yeah, but can you imagine what that would do to the children around them if like the police just like beat Elmo?
And it would tased Elmo and handcuffed him.
It would be even worse if he was wearing a hoodie.
Put Mickey and Minnie in zip ties around their hands. Yeah, this is, I need to take a deep breath. Hold on. It's going to be okay. They're still going to make millions of dollars. I love the rich. Okay, got it. Moving on. I hate these people. But someone I actually like, the Florida man who deliberately scuttled the pay it forward Starbucks line. That's right, I said it, to use a Mark Levin line. A Florida man put an end to another, quote, pay it forward streak at a local Starbucks because he said he thinks people were participating out of guilt, not generosity. Peter Schorsch, a blogger.
You like him so much, you can say his name properly.
I like how they put in his occupation as a blogger.
Dude, who actually makes money from blogging? I want to know.
There's
this.
Like six of them. The guy who runs Instapundit, I'm sure he makes about $20,000 a year or something. Peter Schorsch drove to the Starbucks drive-thru in St. Petersburg, Florida on Thursday after hearing a specific report about the pay-it-forward phenomenon, and he ordered two venti mocha frappuccinos. The barista told him his first drink had been paid for and asked if he wanted to pay for the next customer, and he said no. When the barista asks you to pay for it, he says it is no longer spontaneously paying it forward.
Did when he said no, did the entire restaurant stop moving and it went dead silent?
I could see him screaming no a la Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith.
Or no. did the barista say to him, this is madness? And he said, this is Sparta, and kicked her.
This is Starbucks! And he kicked the venti latte out of her hand. No, none of that happened. In fact, he tipped the barista $100. So take that.
Game, set, match. That's people. A brilliant rhetorical move.
Yes, it is. Because you're like, hey, douche, wait, you just tipped her $100. I'm not going to do that. Yeah. So this whole thing is stupid. And people need to take a deep breath and get over the fact that this guy is not a jerk. And in fact, if you think about the economics of what is going on, no one is really paying it forward. You're just paying Starbucks an extra amount of money. No one is getting something really for free.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the logistics of this because, okay, I know that whoever was before me is paying it forward. So why don't I go in there and order like $20 worth of stuff?
Well, they usually put down a $5 and they're like, this pays for the next person's drink or whatever it is. And the next person comes in and puts down a $5. You realize that the only person that benefits from this is the CEO of Starbucks.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a racket that Starbucks is running. Because they get all the extra overhead. Because it's not $5 for everybody's drink.
Right. They're making a shit ton of extra money on this. And in fact, there have been reports that some Starbucks have initiated the pay it forward lines on their own to make more money, even though Starbucks says they absolutely do not do that.
Yeah, because you know who's making the money then? It's probably they're pocketing it as tips.
Right. The baristas have a huge incentive for this, definitely. So this whole thing is nonsense, and we need to stop paying it forward because we're not really paying it forward. We're just doing this like the letters I can never remember which order bucket challenge.
The JML Icy Bucket Challenge.
JML Icy Blue Bucket Challenge.
Well, you can't do the blue one because at least near me, the blue is a lot heavier for some reason. You would probably break your neck if you poured that on your head.
The blue is heavier?
For some reason, it doesn't freeze properly. I don't know.
And you know this? Like, this is a fact of reality that you have somehow induced?
I drink a lot of ices.
Wow, man.
It may just be the machine across the street from
you
me.
You do so many things that make me think you're a secret pot smoker.
I did get along very well with stoners in high school and college.
What are you having for dinner tonight, Justin? Oh, like 16 feet of kielbasa.
It's good kielbasa. What do you want from me? I'm paying it forward to my colon.
And your heart in 40 years.
40 years? But no, isn't this guy a dick? Couldn't he just do what we all would do? I wouldn't do it, but you get what I'm saying.
No, I don't think this guy is a dick. I think he's a hero. And I'm going to put up a shrine to him. Not really. That costs a lot of money. I don't have that kind of money. If he wants to pay me to put up the shrine, I'll put up the shrine. But otherwise, I'm just going to say that he's not a dick.
Well, you know who always pays it forward?
Kevin Spacey, Helen Hunt, and Haley Joel Osment from the movie Pay It Forward.
Oh, that was a good reference.
Thank you.
That's good today. The Shrek reference, the Pay It Forward reference. Well done.
Thank you.
No. The proper answer is the doctor. Then again, maybe he pays it backwards too. I don't really know. It's all timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly. Anyway, let's Geronimo into the Doctor Who season premiere in TV with JML. Now, Daniel, you are not a Whovian. I have finally convinced you to watch this show because Moffat cast Peter Capaldi. So before we get started really going into analyzing the episode, what are your impressions as a non-Whovian of Doctor Who?
Is Whovian gay slang for something? Oh, no, that's Doctor Who. Got it. Whovian. Whovian. Okay. Where's the V come from? Anyway.
They're British. Don't ask anything.
They throw all kinds of extra letters and words and a U and a G and an H. So here's the thing. Yeah, I'm not, I haven't watched any other episode of Doctor Who except for the one previous to the season opener where Matt Smith turns into Peter Capaldi and
regenerated
turns into, it's a synonym.
No, it's not.
He's got his little sonic wrench out. It's very cool.
Screwdriver.
I knew that.
Bow ties are cool.
So here is the thing about Doctor Who that sort of makes me feel like I have moved to a country where I do not speak the language. And instead of learning the language before going, I've decided, fuck it, I'll learn it when I get there. That is sort of how I feel watching both the season. I don't know if that was a season ending or some sort of Christmas special. See, I don't even get the structure of it.
It's a Christmas special.
See, I don't even. But the town was called Christmas and it was a Christmas. I didn't get it.
Well, that was very meta by Moffat. But no, they build in, Moffat at least, builds in arcs to all of this. So even though it's technically not part of the season, it was part of the overall arc.
Ah, okay. So the overall impression that I have, the high level impression is that there is so much, or at least seemingly so much backstory and mythology that it's like being, you know, dropped into the middle of a Tolkien universe without having read the first book and a half or two books. And you're trying to piece together who these characters are and what their relationships mean. And in many ways, I do have to literally learn the language, like what's going on. And like you said, I was drawn to this because Peter Capaldi is an awesome actor and I loved a lot of his political, work in The Thick of It and, In the Loop and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to watch him be angry and yell fucking fuckface at people, which didn't happen, but it got close.
I would love it if the doctor yelled fucking fuckface at someone. I mean, he pretty much did. He just didn't swear.
Right, he got a little he had that part where he was being a little meta about himself, saying I'm Scottish, I get to complain about things.
That was awesome. I love when Moffat does that.
Yeah, very cool. And the whole thing about the eyebrows, and they're basically an independent state, which is also a meta thing about Scotland. And anyway, so yeah, my overall impression was that I was entertained by Capaldi, which we can talk about later. but that I still have no idea what the hell is going on.
So you weren't entertained by anything else?
Well, I mean, some of the acting was good. I thought Clara was an interesting character, but again, the whole relationship with the previous doctor, I didn't really understand that and why she was so hung up on the fact. It's like, didn't he tell you at some point that he was going to change? Like, isn't this a thing about the doctor? Like a
no,
fact?
The doctor's kind of a dick like that. He just sort of regenerates and then like his companion is always like, what's going on? And has to adjust.
Well, like, so, the moment he changes, doesn't he tell them, like, okay, look, this is normal. I'm going to do this again. So any other companions I have, why don't you tell them that I'm going to change too?
Well, no, you saw what happened. I mean, there's always, the doctor is always confused and doesn't know what's going on. That's why Capaldi was like that. It's not because he was old.
My point is, my point is, doesn't the doctor know at some point he is going to change?
Well, you watched the episode. He called her.
Well, right, but I'm... because he couldn't have told her 2 years ago that, hey, be on the lookout at
some
point.
Are you arguing for naturalism in Doctor Who? It was more dramatic to have him call at the end of the episode because it fit the theme.
All right. So he called. Okay, we're moving on. Just a minor glitch in the storytelling to me, but that's okay. I'm over it already. The dinosaur was cool looking.
No. Okay, we'll get to the dinosaur in a second. But... the theme of this episode, I would argue, is accepting things as they are. That's why it's called Deep Breath. Take a deep breath, relax, it's still the Doctor, it's still Doctor Who, we're moving forward. And that's a lot of what Clara had to do in the episode. Take a deep breath, figure out what was going on. Take a deep breath, and the Doctor figured out what was going on. And that was very much what happened with the villains, right? In order to get away from the villains, what did Clara have to do?
Take a deep breath.
Right. Rather than be scared, because they were robots, they could sense the breathing. So she had to literally hold her breath and then think about it and then get out of there. And she did that twice, and that's what saved her life twice. So that's a very great concretization of the theme in the conflict. Mm-hmm. And also, you don't know this because you don't know the history, but I'm going to ask, have you ever heard of the Doctor Who episode Blink?
Angels?
Yeah, Weeping Angels. Where these villains, I thought, were kind of similar to them. Where the Weeping Angels, if you blinked, they would come and get you. And these villains, if you breathed, they would come and get you. So, some similar writing there by Moffat. Where he has the basic things that humans do make it what the villains are after. The monsters are after. And that's terrifying.
It is. And I tell you, one of the creepier scenes was them standing up in the restaurant, and every time they took a step forward, this group collectively approached them.
Right, that even though I knew that was going to happen.
Well, I'm not a writer.
Oh, that wasn't obvious to you?
Shut up.
Oh, before they got up, I was like, oh, the second they get up, they're all going to move, and the more they move in, that's like in The Legend of Zelda. Aren't there villains who do that? No, it's like Boo in...
In Monsters, Inc.?
No, in Mario Brothers.
Oh, okay.
It's the same as that concept. I guess that's just where I got it from. I don't know. It made sense to me intuitively.
I thought the Weeping Angels were like Boo. Anyway.
They're both like... That's what I just said. They're the same type of villain.
Okay, moving on.
But, okay, now we'll talk about the dinosaur. All right.
Thank you.
We'll talk about the dinosaur and the alley scene in one. Because, for me, this episode was kind of all over the place and didn't really start... And I didn't really click with it until the alley scene. I thought the dinosaur stuff was uninteresting, and I thought it was a cheap ploy just to start in a Michael Bay-esque way.
It was very much a gimmick. Definitely a gimmick. I thought it looked really good for TV green screenery, and I appreciated that. But I did understand that it basically had no relevance to the plot whatsoever. What was I going to say about it? So that's the one other question I had. So you said it was sort of all over the place, which is one thing I didn't know is if this was a typical style of Doctor Who episodes where it sort of shoots back and forth really quickly among a bunch of different things, and there's sort of one plot that sort of gets resolved in the Star Trekian kind of, and we'll fire up the capacitors, and that will reroute the tachyon particles.
Yeah, I was going to say, you better say tachyons in there. You forgot the deflector dish, though.
The tachyons in the deflector dish, and that will short-circuit the Borg, whatever.
And Data will feel emotions.
So I didn't know if that was sort of how all of them resolved, where, like, the Doctor just sort of is like, oh, yeah, I know these monsters. They're the such-and-such from another time, and they replace the whatever. Is that typical? Was this a atypical episode?
No, pretty generally the plots do end that way, where it escalates, and it's sort of very House-like in that way, where the Doctor's trying to figure out what's going on, and he's using trial and error, and it's not until the end that something clicks with him, and finally he solves it. So yeah, it's very House-like, and it's very Star Trek-like in that way. But it's not always that frenetic. A lot of I think the sense that it was frenetic was they were trying to make it exciting to start the new episode, to start the new Doctor, I mean.
Yeah.
And for me, it didn't play until they gave the new Doctor time to breathe, which was the alley scene. To me, that was the first time, you know, they did the reflection, right? He saw the mirror, which they brought back later. You know, part of this was taking a deep breath and accepting things, so they made him accept who he is. So when he finally was in the alley and he could breathe and contemplate these things and maybe figure out if he was the kind of guy who stole someone's coat or not, that it really started to work because I saw the character. Before that, it was all moving too fast, and it felt like it was more focused on the Jenny and Strax and Madame Vidara, I think that's her name, or... She's not named after a...
Lizard Lesbo, that
yeah.
one?
She's probably not named after a hotel in Las Vegas, but...
Who knows?
Yeah. But no, it seemed to be more focused on them.
True, and I did, and again, having no prior relationship, I thought, are these series regulars? Are they special characters for this episode? Why does no one in Victorian London seem to care that she's a lizard?
Well, they explain that. Did you see how they explained that?
The veil. Part.
Right, the veil that people see if they're not ready to accept her.
Right, yeah, no. I got it later, but beginning I was sort of like, why? She's a lizard.
Yeah, and
no
those are, that's part of the mythology you didn't know because they've been in previous episodes.
Yeah, and I got that a little bit later on, but.
Yeah, and speaking of them, I have to say, I absolutely love Strax every time he's on television. He is absolutely hilarious.
See the chunky looking weird thing?
Yes, the chunky looking weird thing.
Yeah. No, he's funny. He's amusing. I like the not understanding human psychology or anatomy or whatever. Kept calling her boy. That was really funny.
Yeah, he's done that for a while. That's a callback joke. And I also love how he always forgets the Doctor isn't his enemy anymore. Because he's a Centauran and the Centaurans are the enemies of the Doctor. So I think it's very, very funny that way. He's kind of like a Ferengi meets a Klingon.
That's a hideous baby. I guess it is, yeah.
All right, so one more question. What do you think of the 12? He's the 12th incarnation of the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Technically 13th if you count the War Doctor, but the War Doctor is unnumbered, and I'm speaking gibberish to you right now.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the dynamic between this old fart and this young Clara?
So I thought it was partially... So it was uncomfortable at first, but I think the point was that it was supposed to be uncomfortable at first, so I applaud the writers on that.
And the actors.
And the actors, definitely. I thought the two shining actors of that episode were far and away Capaldi and whoever plays Clara.
Jenna Louise Coleman.
Her. Thought they were outstanding in their roles. And then, but the transition point, and of course this was meant to be the transition point, the phone call and where he asks, or when he says, I don't think you see me. And he becomes vulnerable in that moment. I thought it was an excellent transition and sort of her taking the deep breath and joining him. I look forward to seeing how that relationship grows because I think it's going to be still somewhat awkward because I think he's going to be, I don't know if all doctors are awkward. Certainly Matt Smith was
yes.
a little weird.
Yes. They're all awkward.
But I think that relationship is going to have an even newer awkward dynamic because of his age and grumpiness.
Yeah, and that's what I really liked about that is that's what I mean when I say the alley scene is where the episode picked up for me, because that's really when that thread started to be chased or started to be traced is the word I was looking for. Because before that, he was just sort of a prop in the episode, right? He was the crazy old dude who they were trying to keep locked in the bed, who said some funny stuff and then dove in the water. And before that, he was a prop almost. He was almost a prop equivalent to the dinosaur. But then in that alley scene, it started this whole transition where he had to admit he needed help, which is a much different dynamic from, I mean, forget the age thing. We'll talk about the age thing in a minute here in Yahoo Answers, but it's a much different dynamic for the Doctor and the Companion than I've seen in all of the New Who, where they rebooted in 2005.
New Who.
Is that a search engine?
Yeah. Or a chocolatey drink.
It's a much different dynamic where you talk about, you know, Rose and the Doctor and Martha and the Doctor and Donna and the Doctor and...
Vince.
There was no Vince. I can't... Amy and the Doctor. All of these different companions. I probably missed a companion and pissed off every Doctor Who fan. But all of them were looking to the Doctor for strength and they needed the Doctor. Well, now I really like that even though the Doctor is like the super smart, super awesome guy, he needs Clara. And I don't like it in any way that's supposed to be like tearing down of people who are super smart and super able and saying that everybody needs someone. I'm just saying I think it's a good change in dynamic for the show versus what they've been doing.
Hmm. That's interesting. I think one sort of theme throughout the episode that I really appreciated, it wasn't the main theme, but it was related. I think it supports the main theme, is the idea of identity and what it means to be who you are or what it means to be even greater. And that was concretized through the villains in this who were out to replace their various parts and whatnot until they reached the promised land. And then it was also concretized, of course, in the changing of the Doctor, and is he still the same person? Clara saying, I don't think I know him anymore. Those kind of things. And then the sort of speech that the Doctor gives to the villain at the end, where he talks about the broom and if the handle breaks and you replace the handle and then the whisks break and you replace the whisks, do you have the same broom or not? And of course he says no about the broom, but then there's that great visual scene of him holding up the plate and the bad guy seeing his reflection, but then you go over Capaldi's shoulder and you can see the Doctor's reflection in it as well. And it's a moment to contemplate whether or not this is the same person, whether it can be philosophically the same person or not. I think it's a deep question for a show.
I think one of the things that people miss about Moffat is the integration that around the theme that you're talking about here. Everything you just said is insanely intelligent and insanely intricate, yet somehow he's found a way to integrate it in with the villain and the characters and their conflicts internally and the conflicts with the villain. And this is surely all part of an overall arc that he's building towards. And that's insane that someone can do that, that build it on that level.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very good writing, very good directing. I don't know if Moffat also directed, but...
No, Moffat's not a director. But he's the showrunner, so he has a large influence on the director.
Yeah, just really good. So, right, the frenetic nature of it, it didn't make me, you know, stand up at the end and yell, like, this is the best show I've ever seen! But the good acting and the good writing, especially in the theme, the writing of the theme, is going to keep me going, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. It's not the best Who episode I ever saw, but it was Moffat being typical Moffat in that what I mean is there were a couple scenes where I applauded the writing and I was very aware and I said, wow, this is really moving me. This is very, very good. And that doesn't happen in a lot of television and movies. So that's why I love Doctor Who, especially since Moffat took over as the showrunner. If you're waiting for us to talk about what we thought of Capaldi as a Doctor, you can let that breath out. Someone asked about it in Yahoo Answers.
Just another question. Just another answer, I won't begin. And just another question. Just another answer, I won't begin.
First question. Thoughts about Peter Capaldi being the 12th Doctor? Most people say he looks too unattractive and doesn't have enough sex appeal to be the Doctor. Which, unsurprisingly, most of them are teenage girls. But this makes me a bit mad. I've seen him in lots of TV shows and movies before, and I think he would be perfect as the new Doctor.
And he's totally doable. Oh, he doesn't write that? Okay, sorry.
You want to tell us something?
Oh, no.
Just trying to make up for Elliot not being here?
There has to be some homoerotic element to the show.
When Elliot comes back next week and we talk about the second episode, then we will ask him if Peter Capaldi is doable.
Okay, all right.
As for now, what I want to say to this, before we go to your thoughts, Daniel, I actually think Moffat did one of these brilliant things that I love when writers do sometimes, and it's when they get meta without acknowledging to anyone that they're getting meta. And what I mean by this is, he actually wrote this whole episode to sort of make fun of these people who said that it's stupid that, one, Matt Smith and David Tennant were considered sex symbols, especially Matt Smith, and two, saying transitioning to an older Doctor who isn't as good looking as Matt Smith will lose a lot of those female viewers. Because the whole plot was about how not Clara considered the Doctor her boyfriend, but the Doctor considered himself Clara's boyfriend, and that was their relationship, and that, you know, that was the appeal of the show to those girls, but they had to learn to readjust the same way Clara was learning to readjust. So there's this added layer into the episode that I knew was there the whole time, and I just thought was absolutely hilarious that Moffat addressed this in his writing.
He was addressing the Doctor Who shippers.
Exactly.
The Who shippers.
Ooh. That's so much better than Whovians.
Thank you. Two episodes. Thank you. So Capaldi is the reason I'm watching this, and there is a reason for that, which is his work is usually outstanding. And not just because, like I said, he can yell a string of profanities like no one else except a teenager playing Mario Kart, but because he is
playing Mario Kart when I get a fucking blue shell.
Yes, blue shell right in the keister. But he is a tremendous actor with his facial expressions and the nuances of what he can express. He is one of the rare actors who can transition an emotion midline, usually. And I think you saw that a little bit in this episode, especially toward the end, when he was coming out to ask for help, and then later the whole coffee business. But he's a very nuanced actor, and I thought he brought that to this role, and I look forward to even more of it, because he's doable, totally just doable. I mean, good. He's a good actor. You know what I meant.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'm interested to see where he goes from here, because I was totally a Matt Smith Moffat fan. I had enjoyed Doctor Who prior to Matt Smith, but I didn't love it on the level I loved it when Matt Smith was the Doctor. A lot of that has to do with the character of Rory as well. But I think Capaldi has the potential to be my second favorite or even my favorite Doctor, depending on what happens next. So I think it was brilliant casting. I was only aware of him with his short clip of making fun of Star Wars previously.
Legos! They're all made of fucking Legos.
You got a pretty good Capaldi impersonation.
I can do a little bit of Scottish, but only in short bits. If you asked me to do a whole rant, I would be terrible at it. Just like little words and whatever. But I've watched the thick of it like 7 times in its entirety, so.
Oh, that's probably where you picked up some of it from.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think he was really good casting. We're gonna see where it goes. I'm really excited for the season. It feels good that we're getting back into the TV season and there's something really epic on TV right now besides The Strain. Because I feel like I've been sort of...
Strained?
Yeah, I've been strained with the things I've been watching as of late. I've seen every episode of Girl Meets World, and I got excited when they brought Minkus back. So that's where my TV viewing's been at.
Wow, what a low right there.
Hey, well, Boy Meets World is my favorite sitcom ever, but it pales in comparison. Next question. When someone takes a really deep breath, what are they feeling/thinking? When someone takes a really deep breath in, what does it indicate about how they are feeling or what they are thinking? in terms of nonverbal communication. Thanks. It'd be really hard to have verbal communication if you took a deep breath in.
How are you doing today? I'm really great. It's really hard to do.
Aren't they just saying they farted when they do that?
Is this question answerable? I mean, really? Can we give a legitimate answer, or would we just be bullshitting? Because I'm fine with bullshitting. We do that most of the time. But there are some questions that actually you can actually answer, and this one, they're literally asking us to tell them what every single person on the planet is feeling when they're taking a deep breath.
Well, they're feeling that they just farted. I thought I answered this.
No, that might be you, or most men, but
well, I think
not
there's
everyone.
I think there's a whole spectrum here, right? I don't think we can give one answer, because as you're saying, everyone's different, but I think there's a spectrum.
It's on the spec?
Yes. No, I do think, I mean, forget the spectrum. I mean, figure out the spectrum yourself. But I do think you raise a really good point about, are they really asking us what a person is thinking? Because this is something that even I fell into a trap to when I was younger, is always saying, oh, well, what does this mean, what this person did? As if you could somehow randomly hear what this person did out of context of A, the situation, and every event of that person's life, and know what it meant, because every person has the same motivation for everything they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a commonly held belief, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a psychologizing culture. But
where do you think that comes from?
I had to take a deep breath. I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. Maybe the fact that we have started, and again, you can ask a never-ending series of where did that come from, but maybe a sort of preoccupation with intention and feeling versus action. I think it arises along with the popularity of like, and I don't mean that in just the tick of people just saying like in the middle of a sentence, but when people started actually using it to a large extent to express sort of how they would have felt or how they did feel, but not how they actually acted. And then I was like, whoa, back off, bro. But in real life, they said, excuse me, sir, could you please step away a little?
How did you know what I do with people?
Exactly. So I don't know, and I don't know where that comes from. Maybe an incessant narcissism, and that comes from many things, but.
Well, what do you think about biological determinism affecting this?
Wow. And bringing it down.
What I mean by it is the idea that we're all biologically determined to act certain ways. And because of the way our biology is, there are certain manifestations of behavior. Because, for instance, when my cats do certain things, I know what they're doing. Right, I know why my cat says hi the way she says hi. And I know if her tail's raised or if it's bent a little, what all these things mean.
Because you're a crazy cat man?
No, because I read the internet. Every time my cat does something weird, I Google, why is my cat trying to do a handstand? And why have I not put this on YouTube?
Yes. So biological
or a paw stand, if you will.
So how does this apply to humans?
Well, I'm saying we try to see human behavior the same way we would see animal behavior.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that every thing has some instinctual meaning or subconscious meaning.
Right. There's no intentionality of our actions. We're not choosing to act a certain way. We're acting the way we have to act based upon our biological composition.
Yeah. Those people can suck it.
But I'm not saying it's true. I'm not arguing for it. I'm saying,
okay.
Don't you think that's why people ask these questions? Because they're assuming biological determinism without realizing it.
I think to some degree that's very true. And especially warning alert, I don't mean this to deride science per se. Science is awesome. But fuck Neil deGrasse Tyson. But science is awesome. I think as we become a culture that steps further away from philosophical ideas and principles and more to a pragmatic scientific world, we're going to be more and more predisposed to thinking about biologically determined behaviors, and we're going to start and continue to negate will and choice as actually having importance.
Right, and to ground that in something we always talk about here in the Midside is that's a lot of how feminism views men.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, they just have an uncontrollable sex drive, and because of that they're, you know, they're sexually oppressive, and it's up to women to control, or women to control men. Because men
right.
instinctively can't control themselves. They just want sex all the time.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about penetration again, are we? That made me very uncomfortable.
You got uncomfortable over Skype?
Yeah.
No, we aren't. But we are going to talk about the next question.
Woohoo!
How to build anticipation? Question mark?
Just like that. Bitches.
The funny thing is, there was, when you clicked through, there was nothing written there. So I didn't know if it was
trolling you.
Was it a meta question?
I think he was trolling you. How to build anticipation? Click here to find out.
It was listed though under books and authors. So I'm assuming they mean how to build anticipation in a story.
Yeah, probably. So, writer, how do you build anticipation?
You don't, you just make stuff blow up.
Michael Bayit.
Yep, that's it.
I'm okay with that.
No, you don't, it's all about pacing. Anticipation is all about pacing. And it's all about doling out a little bit to tease that more is going to be coming. I mean, this is the reason people have a love-hate relationship with J.J. Abrams. If you want to know how to build anticipation, it's his mystery box metaphor, right? Where you always have the mystery inside the box, and then when you open the box, there's another box.
Another box?
Another door. Another door. Right, exactly. And that's what builds anticipation, is you're always getting somewhere, but then you always realize there's another place to get to.
Mm-hmm. And I think the opposite advice of that is don't shoot your wad right away. And what I mean by that in a non-sexual metaphor is, especially in a lot of movies now, we sort of open up and in the first however many minutes, and there's some formula that dictates this, we have to have some huge explosion and action scene and whatever.
Or a dinosaur.
Versus go back and watch some older movies, and Adam Kroll actually talked about this in regards to The Shining recently. So go back and watch The Shining, which is one of the scariest fucking movies ever. For an hour, nothing fucking happens in The Shining. But at every moment, you think that's going to be the moment that something happens. But by the time that something actually does happen, you are so psychologically ready for it that it feels like the scariest thing ever.
Right, because they're playing with expectation, and that's a major thing with anticipation, is you have to expect things, right? It's the whole, this is a good metaphor for it. The worst part of a roller coaster is going up the giant fucking hill slowly at the beginning with the clicking. If it wasn't so slow and it didn't have the clicking, it wouldn't be scary. That's literally, every time I go up a roller coaster, I'm like, this is stupid. Why did I do this? Why am I doing this? What is going on? Because I don't really like heights. So as I'm going up, all I'm thinking about is, if this fell off, I would die. This is awful. Why am I doing this? And then I get to the top and I go down and I'm like, this is really fun.
Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're on a roller coaster. That's not the song.
It's also not on cadence at all.
And so the point here to continue the sexual metaphor is foreplay. You want to build anticipation? Foreplay. Foreplay, 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 until the point where she's begging for it.
I'm the Michael Bay of sex.
2 seconds in, boom! Done.
Yep.
Ready for the sequel?
Then you say some stilted Mark Wahlberg dialogue, and then boom! And then again.
Yep.
Next question?
Oh, please.
I have social anxiety, but I don't get panic attacks. I don't get panic attacks. Does that mean I still have social anxiety, or is it something else?
Wait, you just told us you have social anxiety.
I'm not a doctor. I have to rely on you.
What is with the package dealing of panic attacks and social anxiety?
I don't know. It's bizarre. You don't just have panic attacks. Panic attacks are dreadful and they're deeply disturbing. But you can have them and not have social anxiety. They're not related. Panic attacks can be, it doesn't have to be social anxiety. It could be anxiety to do with work or anxiety to do with fear of germs or just sort of anxiety about dying. It doesn't have to be social.
I'd love a college party where anyone who has social anxiety has a panic attack. The second anyone walked into that party, there'd be social anxiety. And then there'd be one person you wouldn't expect to not have social anxiety and be like, what is going on with all of you right now?
Why are you all in the fetal position crying? This party's lame.
Because doesn't everybody or most people have some measure of social anxiety?
Yeah, definitely, especially in the neurotic society we live in. I think clinically social anxiety means social anxiety to the point that actually stops you from having normal social relationships with people.
Well, then what's normal? I mean, that's a bad word to use.
Yeah, I'm not a clinical psychologist, but the point simply being, like, you don't really make friends or you never go on dates or you never...
Why do you think that is, that you're not a clinical psychologist?
Thank you. I think it's because I want to have sex with my mother. Okay. You probably have social anxiety. One, because everyone does. But two, if you can sort of, it's one of the things you can really sort of self-identify. It doesn't take a clinical psychologist to tell you that you shit your pants every time you think about going to a party. Like that's, you can introspect that one.
And we'll leave you with that. Introspect it. You figure it out. Last question. What is Veil of Ignorance? And I say it like that because that's how they wrote it. Can someone define what is Veil of Ignorance? How is Veil of Ignorance was based from deontology? TY for the help. But can you guys post something that is not from Google search result? Thanks.
So we are writing this kid's philosophy paper.
This guy updated this to complain that people were just giving him Google results.
I can't write that in my paper. I'll totally be found out and kicked out of my school.
That'll obviously be plagiarism.
School. Yeah. So what is Veil of Ignorance? If I remember correctly, Veil of Ignorance is from Rawls and Rawls' theory of justice. And the idea was the only way we can make a correct moral political choice was if we basically pretended like we didn't know who we were or what our status was in life or what anyone else's status was in life or who anyone else was, and we answered questions like, how should resources be allocated that way? So that we had basically zero self-interest in the allocation of these things. And that could be the only fair way to divvy out resources. Now, some Rawls expert, especially in the talkbacker audience, is going to be like, that's not exactly what he was saying. What he really meant was this. Rawls experts are all comic book guy from The Simpsons.
I think Rawls was saying with this quote that we need to desalinate the ocean.
Everyone should be saying that with their quotes. Oh, God. So I think that's basically the Veil of Ignorance. If someone wants to write back and explain a nuance of it and not be a complete prick about it, we would appreciate that. Do you have anything to add to that?
Sounds stupid to me.
Well, it's completely impossible and it is stupid and there's actually no given reason for why that must be it. So, and this is why all altruism fails, because all you have to do is ask the question, why? And you say, well, it's good for others. Well, you should do for others and never think about yourself. Well, why? Because that's what morality is. Well, why do you define it that way?
So the Veil of Ignorance is the ice bucket challenge?
Callback, sir. Well done. And in terms of how it applies to Kant's deontology, I don't even know what that fucking means. I'm not a philosophy major. Kant's ethics were similar to the veil of ignorance in that he basically had duty ethics, which is you need to
poop.
Yes. Scheiße. He was German. He was German. Kant. You have to sort of do what is good, and what is good is defined as basically anything that doesn't benefit you in any way whatsoever. Again, Kantian experts. We can't say it. But Kant's a douche.
According to Wikipedia, Veil of Ignorance is the fifth studio album by Swedish hardcore punk band Raised Fist. It was released in September of 2009 on Burning Heart Records.
I can't believe it.
It features such songs as Friends and Traitors, They Can't Keep Us Down, Volcano Is Me, Words and Phrases, and Never Negotiate.
Well, there you go, fine sir.
It was number 29 on the Finnish albums chart and number 22 on the Swedish albums chart. Aren't there only 22 artists in Sweden?
There are only 29 people in Sweden total.
This just means it was sold at IKEA, right?
It's what they use to hold up the tables, the lac tables.
All right, you know who else took deep breaths this weekend? Broncos and Rams fans. Find out why next in the non-crisis of the week. We're only in the preseason, but major injuries have already hit the NFL. Wes Welker, the former Patriots wide receiver and current Broncos wide receiver, suffered his third concussion in a year. And Sam Bradford, the supposed star quarterback of the Rams, tore his ACL and is out for the season. So this is what I want to know. I'm going to actually subvert the premise of our segment.
Oh, God.
Does this actually prove there is an injury crisis in the NFL? Is it too dangerous of a game?
Because two players were injured preseason?
Two major players! These are stars! I don't know how Sam Bradford's a star. He never plays.
Right, Sam Bradford has played 1 year. How he's a star? He's a broken man-child.
He does look like he's 12.
Yes. No, I don't think there's an injury. First of all, it is a sport where injuries are known and an inherent part of the game. Just as if I was doing Alaskan crab fishing, I would know that my mortality rate is higher than any job in the world. And yes, you try your best to reduce that as an industry so you can get better and better people. But you're never going to eliminate risk. And we need to stop thinking that we can eliminate risk in our lives ever.
Is Alaskan crab fishing really the job with the highest mortality rate?
It's up there. It's very high.
How do you know that?
Because of Deadliest Catch on the Discovery Channel.
Oh, okay.
So the point is, very simply, everything has risk. The risk should be explained. The NFL should have, for instance, done better explaining the risks about head injuries and such to players. They got it wrong on that one. But you're never going to eliminate it. And to think that we should even hope that someday that there will be no risk to play football or there will be no risk to Alaskan crab fishing is nonsense. Living is a giant risk. And the point is, what is the reward? What do I get out of this?
Wait, it's a giant board where I move pieces around and get really annoyed that I can never get a good roll.
Just put it all in the purples. Build up on Australasia.
This is what I want to know about this story. Is Wes Welker going to come back with an even bigger helmet now?
Not possible. He and Peyton, although in different directions, are vying for world's biggest helmet.
Do you think Welker bases his helmet on Peyton Manning's forehead?
Collectively, the Broncos have 20% of all helmet size in the NFL.
And a serious question, how long until the Rams give up on Sam Bradford?
I think they're going to give him this one last season, and the next season he's going to starting to be like, my ankle. He's going to tear his ankle or something because he's a giant man-child. And then they're going to drop him for good and go with Ryan Mallett.
I actually have seen that speculation already because Jimmy Garoppolo is doing so awesome, and he's actually getting the start in the Patriots' fourth preseason game. So I've seen some speculation that Belichick might try and deal Mallett to St. Louis.
Smart on Belichick's part. I don't know if he's the kind of person St. Louis is looking for. They're looking for someone who looks like if you had sex with them, you'd be put in jail. But, you know,
Mallett's
maybe.
Too tall. He doesn't have like a almost Jufro.
His jaw is too chiseled.
I'm not sure Ryan Mallett would be much of a step up either. I mean, sometimes I wonder about backup quarterbacks in the NFL. If people just keep them because they don't want to bother looking for another one. I mean, either Jimmy Garoppolo is going to be like the second coming of Brady, or Ryan Mallett's that bad. Because I've watched Ryan Mallett for the past three, now this is his fourth preseason, and he's looked awful in every game he's played in. And now Jimmy Garoppolo's coming in and outplaying him. So
yeah.
I wonder
Ouch.
Why Mallett was even on the roster. You're telling me there wasn't a better backup QB out there that they could have gotten cheaply?
Well, they had Castle for a while, right?
Yeah, but not when they had Mallett.
Hmm. Well, did they get Mallett because they traded away Castle?
Yeah, because they knew... Castle was gone. They got Mallett because Hoyer, who's now starting for the Browns, was leaving. Because he was going to be a free agent and demand too much money. And that's why people thought they drafted Garoppolo now, because Mallett was going to leave. But I don't know why anyone would want Mallett ever.
I don't know.
And this is
Jacksonville.
No, Blake Bortles is going to be good.
But... Blake Bortles. Sounds like a fucking Pokemon.
And this has been your segment on the New England Patriots backup quarterbacks. Most obscure, useless segment ever. At one point, Tom Tupa was the punter and the third string quarterback.
We sound like an SNL sketch. What are they saying? Duh, Patriots.
Somebody's going to do it. All right. Let's wrap this thing up. What did we learn this week, Daniel?
I learned they have the fucking Patriots have had so many goddamn backup quarterbacks. No, just kidding. I think what I really learned is that there are a lot of Disney euphemisms for gay sex.
I think there's just a lot of euphemisms for gay sex.
Yeah, I guess. But Disney, I think, lends itself to, like, rubbing the lamp is another one. Or, you know, dressing the chipmunks.
Or what about the song I Want to Be Like You, where the monkey sings to the human?
Uh-huh. Or squeezing Dale's nose. That's what I couldn't come up with a moment ago.
I think you can come up with better ones than that.
Oh, I'm sure. You can tweet them at us. Hashtag gay Disney sex.
Watch that become an at midnight Twitter war, whatever it's called.
We'll know for sure. Hashtag Hardwick stealing war. From us.
And I've learned how to feel really bad when Elliot, the biggest Whovian of us all, cannot be here for this episode. So look for him next week so you can have one of your own make fun of us while we try and talk about Doctor Who. I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce. Blip, 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 blip. Again from the top. I was so good too, and then blip.